My name is Laura Romneres, and I have lived in Grant County since 1992. I raised my children here, and once they left home to go to school, I went to school myself, first at WNMU, then to Antioch University. I have worked in the field of conflict resolution for 15 years now, providing conflict intervention services, serving as a consultant and conflict coach, and facilitating workshops on conflict-related topics locally, at the state level, and at the national level. I wanted to speak to you all today about the concept of social resiliency and two related projects I'm working on. I first began to think about social resiliency in the fall of 2005 when I had the opportunity to join a group from Grant County that was working in a warehouse serving a refugee center for hurricane survivors at Kelly Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. At the time, I was in my second year of my Master's of Conflict Resolution program. I made a deal with my professors to use the time away from my current classes to document my observations of the refugee center and provide some analysis. While working at the refugee center, I interviewed some of the Federal Incident Command team members and some of the people working for Shaw Group, a private company partnering with the federal ICT. One person I spoke with on the incident command team was a fire chief from rural Idaho. At one point in our discussion, he commented that the social fabric of our society is very fragile and that it doesn't take much to tear it. Too many tears, too close together in time, could easily result in the mayhem of societal collapse. Given the right circumstances, a community that has been reasonably peaceful could turn into a war zone very quickly, with neighbors fighting each other over basic needs such as food, water, and housing. They would also fight over political power, power over the community itself. He pointed out that all the systems that provide us with our basic needs are subject to many forces outside the control of most individuals. History has shown that scarce resources exacerbate existing intergroup tensions, such as those along the lines of economic class, race, religion, and political power. These tensions are usually somewhat static, so most of us are not aware of them most of the time. Since that conversation all those years ago, I find myself assessing the status of these societal fault lines and the external pressures upon them. As I've listened in on the valuable discussions on environmental and economic sustainability, my thoughts have gone to the importance of social resiliency in ensuring the well-being of our larger community. This seems to be a piece missing from most of the sustainability puzzle. If we can get to the point of providing all our basic needs locally, food, shelter, transportation, education, etc., but we are at war with our neighbors because of unaddressed intergroup relation problems, none of us will truly be safe. In conflict intervention, there is a cornerstone concept, enlightened self-interest. One need not be altruistic at all to enter into a collaborative mode within a given conflict. One only needs to understand that if my neighbor is hungry, it is not too surprising if they sneak some vegetables from my garden. If I move into a neighborhood and don't take the time and energy to introduce myself to others in the neighborhood, should I be surprised if they seem wary or distrustful of me? If I have just moved into town and try to influence local policy without investigating the reasons long-term residents may have for their resistance to a particular policy, should I wonder that they seem to resent me? Enlightened self-interest means that I try to understand the realities and needs of others, if only to make my own life more manageable. In other words, we are all one. And it helps if we act with that reality in mind. The harm that others experience often translates into harm to ourselves. What affects one group negatively also impacts the rest of the community. Children who grow up in violent households may grow up to become violent with their own families or engage in violent crime against strangers. Children who are denied high-quality education will not be able to use all their potential as adults to benefit their own communities. If we do not take good care of our senior citizens, then we will not be well cared for once we are seniors. If we harm our natural environment, then we will not be able to have what we need to lead high-quality lives: clean air, water, and soil, healthy food, and psychological well-being. So how do we protect or strengthen our social fabric? Mostly, it's in the little things. Educate ourselves about local history, up to the present-day dynamics between groups. We can take the time to get to know people outside our usual social groups. Go to others' meetings and listen a lot and speak little. Offer to help with causes you don't normally concern yourself with. Support the existing efforts instead of telling people who have been doing the work how they should do it differently. Offer to pick up groceries for a sick neighbor, even if you can't stand their choice in political candidates. Look for win-win solutions to conflicts that arise, even when you don't particularly like the person you are in conflict with. Social resiliency doesn't mean that we all have to be best friends, but that we practice constructive problem-solving nevertheless for the sake of the whole community. For example, one day I saw from my house, just off Highway 90, a cat dead on the side of the highway. The cat looked like my own young cat, and since he wasn't in the house at the time, I believed that it was him lying dead in the road. I raced out to the highway to move him out of the way of the oncoming traffic. Several cars were coming right then, and I held my hand up to direct them to the other lane. Lucky for me, they all saw me, panicked as I was, and I wasn't hit myself. As I came to the cat and looked at it, I saw that it wasn't mine after all, but a neighbor's cat. In the meantime, a woman I didn't know had pulled over and came running over to me. I felt shocked and saddened by the sight of the newly killed cat and started crying over it as I tried to figure out how to get it out of the road. By the woman's dress and vehicle, I could see that she was probably of a different political persuasion from myself. But there she was by my side, saying, "You don't have to deal with this alone. I'll help you." With a piece of cloth she had gotten from her car, she carefully lifted the cat for me and moved it out of the way of traffic onto the side of the road where whoever owned it could see it. Then she gave me a big hug. Though motivated by simple compassion and her own love of animals, that woman provided a wonderful example of how easy it can be to help build social resiliency. The next time I see someone dressed the way she was, with the kind of bumper stickers she had, I'll be just a little less likely to put that person into the them category and more likely to think of him or her as one of us. I won't assume that we're going to be best friends, but there will be a little more room inside of me for the possibility of positive connection. I'm grateful to that woman whose name I didn't get and who I haven't seen since for this helpful lesson on reaching across lines that normally divide us. When we are not disagreeing in a meeting or campaigning for different candidates or on opposite sides of various fences, we can still create bonds with others around the things that we do have in common, such as our love for our pets, our children, our elderly folks, our desire to eat healthy food, and to live in a safe community. Each one of us has the power to cultivate connections across such lines each and every day without even interrupting the flow of that day. We can open a door, give a genuine smile to the stranger ahead of us in a line, tell the grocery store checkout person to have a good day before they have a chance to say it to you, respond kindly to a wrong number. We all make that mistake once in a while. Every one of us has immense power to positively influence the world we share together just as we move through our everyday lives. To understand what I mean, take a moment now to think about people you've known in your own life who make you feel good just being in their presence. What are they doing or how are they being that makes you feel that way? Who in your life has intervened in a dangerous situation, providing immediate safety and finding a way to keep others safe? Who gave you something you needed right when you needed it? Food, shelter, encouragement, information? Who has ever helped you to have a conversation with another person that was just too hard to have by yourself? We have all had these kinds of experiences. Those individuals may not have thought they were doing anything big, but you can now see how their actions made a significant difference in your life. Likewise, you are making a difference in the lives of those around you, whether that difference is positive or negative. William Ury, a veritable god in the field of conflict resolution, wrote a book called The Third Side, which tells us that although we think that conflicts have two sides, there's actually a third side, us. Mr. Ury outlines three main ways to influence social resiliency: prevent conflict, resolve existing conflict, and contain conflicts that are resistant to resolution. Within these three categories, he identifies 10 particular roles that anyone can play in their community, however they define it, to keep conflict to a minimum, facilitate durable resolution to existing conflicts, and to minimize the damage caused by longer-standing conflicts. These roles can be formal or informal, spontaneous or planned, short-term interventions or long-term projects, paid or volunteer, and can be executed on an individual, local, national, or international scale. Most of us are participating as third-siders without even thinking about it. By learning about and exploring the dynamics of conflict, individual and societal, we can participate more deliberately and effectively in positively affecting those around us and supporting the strength of our overall community. A concept related to the third side is something called ally behavior, or the bystander effect, which is getting a lot of attention these days. Ally behavior is any action we take that supports a vulnerable person or group of people that we ourselves do not belong to. White abolitionists, people of means who work to reduce poverty, adults who advocate for senior citizens or young people, and able-bodied people who pass legislation to strengthen accessibility for all are all examples of allies. Ally behavior can be as simple and easy as a straight person wearing a rainbow ally pin to let LGBTQI people know that you are a safe person to be around, or the effort can be as time and labor intensive and risky as when white people participated in the freedom rides in the civil rights era. I will be launching a project soon called the Ally Project to inspire constructive ally behavior. The vision of the Ally Project is of a world where advantaged people recognize and use the power that comes with that advantage to promote safety and justice for those who lack it. Most of us have some dimensions of advantage and disadvantage. While I am a woman of color and so experience both sexism and racism, I'm also of a straight sexual orientation, am able-bodied, and have the benefit of college education. I can use my position in these advantaged categories to advocate for those who do not have that benefit. I can speak up when someone makes a homophobic comment. I can advocate for making my workplace more accessible and can talk to policymakers about making education affordable. That's ally behavior. Remember, to paraphrase H.L. Mencken, it is not the actions of our enemies that hurts us the most, but the silence of our friends. And Mahatma Gandhi, silence is the voice of complicity. What we refrain from doing creates our shared world as much as what we do. Not saying something is saying something, whether we like it or not. I think most people believe it doesn't make any sense to judge someone by the color of their skin or by an ethnic group they belong to or their religion, etc. So the Ally Project isn't about white people versus people of color, or Protestants versus Catholics or Jews, straight people versus gay people, but about people who believe that people should not be judged or targeted by the color of their skin, their religion, their sexual orientation. We don't have to fully understand the experiences of others to believe that they are treated differently than we are in some way. In fact, it's not possible for any of us to really understand what it's like to belong to a group that we ourselves do not belong to. To minimize another's experience, one we don't share, is like telling someone who is standing in the rain while you sit under a covered porch that it's not raining just because you yourself are not wet. Just because you are not experiencing something yourself does not mean it does not exist for others. Even though I have had gay and lesbian friends since I was in high school, it still didn't really start sinking in how much more vulnerable to physical and emotional violence they are in our society until I had a kind of epiphany in my early 20s when one gay friend came out to me. As I walked along the Santa Fe Plaza holding hands with my then husband, it suddenly hit me how dangerous it would be for my gay friend to do such a simple, harmless thing as holding hands with the man he loved in public. I knew he didn't even dare. Still, since I don't live with that reality every moment of every day as gay people do, it's easy for me to forget. I also have a hard time really imagining what it must be like for people with physical disabilities to function in a world designed for able-bodied people. This doesn't make me a bad person, and I don't feel guilty about it. It just means that's how it is when you don't live with a particular disadvantage every day. However, this realization helps me to constantly strive to be sensitive to others' realities. I don't know of all the divisions that exist in Grant County, but I know of some. Old-timers and new arrivals. People whose families have been here for generations have a different perspective than people who have come here from somewhere else. Race and ethnicity. While New Mexico is a minority-majority state, one that has more people of color than of white or Anglo people, the disparities between the two groups are huge. Poverty, higher incidence of certain health problems, and less access to health care, lower graduation rates, and other problems are significantly more of an issue in communities of color. Present-day realities have their roots in the history of this area. Haves and have-nots. Like everywhere else, there are people here who have easier access to basic material resources, healthy food, transportation, education, housing, etc. Instead of going to a third world country to help people in poverty, consider volunteering for one of the local organizations addressing these needs, or start a project of your own. Better still, go to the third world to help and help here. Environmentalists and anti-environmentalists. While this is a values-based division and one that is unlikely to be resolved once and for all, there are ways to reduce the damage caused by this ongoing conflict. We can strengthen our connections as individuals along the concerns we have in common, such as elder care, food sustainability, and high quality and safe schools for our children. These shared concerns across such divisions are called cross-cutting ties. Political spectrum. Again, this is a division that is not going to go away, but the damage along these lines can be mitigated by strengthening the cross-cutting ties that I've mentioned. Remember, each and every day, we make choices that can increase the positive effect we have on those around us and can strengthen the social fabric of Grant County as we do so. By taking the time to get to know each other in a day-to-day way, we are less likely to demonize each other and to act according to that perception. Notice the other groups around you. Learn about others' realities, keeping in mind that they themselves, not you, are the experts on their experience. Ask respectful questions and take time to digest their answers. You don't have to change your own opinions at all to understand another's experience. And most of all, have compassion for yourself as you open yourself to understanding more about your neighbors. None of us can fully understand the vast complexity of the world around us, including the many facets of our shared community. It's an ongoing process, and one that may take us through surprisingly rich and beautiful territory as we go.